This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're continuing our conversation on how to eradicate poverty around the world with Kristalina Georgieva, the CEO of the World Bank. We're pleased to have her with us for a few more minutes, so if you do have questions for her, do send them in right away. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@wamu.org. 40 years ago, an economics professor in Bangladesh launched a revolution with a crazy idea that a bank could trust someone with no credit, give loans with no collateral, and expect to get paid back. That crazy idea from Muhammad Yunus launched the Grameen Bank and won him the Nobel Peace Prize for proving the skeptics wrong. His systems of microlending and microcredit gave small loans, a few hundred dollars here, a thousand there, maybe less, but enough to totally transform the lives of the poor, especially poor women. Today, Yunus is trying to launch another capitalist revolution, not to destroy the system, but to rethink it, and to make more room for altruistic entrepreneurs who are driven by more than profit, if they even care about profit at all. His new book is called A World of Three Zeros, The New Economics of Zero Poverty, Zero Unemployment, and Zero Net Carbon Emissions. Muhammad Yunus, welcome to 1A.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
I wonder if you could give us your perspective on where we're, how we're doing with the fight against poverty overall. Clearly, as Ms. Georgieva has laid out, we've made progress over recent decades. There are certain reports that show that some of that may be slipping, sliding backwards. From your perspective, how are we doing? Are things getting better? Are they getting worse? Are they about the same?
There are hopes. There are things have done, have been achieved. Like Bangladesh, for example, achieved the Millennium Development Goal number one to reduce poverty by half by 2015. Actually, Bangladesh has done it 2.5 years before 2015. So this is a tremendous achievement. And we are looking forward to achieve the zero poverty by 2030, which is the SDG goal, Sustainable Development Goal. But while we do that, I have to emphasize that there's improvement, but there's no solution. It's not the end of the story there, because basic point that I want to raise that poverty is not created by the poor people. It's created by the system that we built. Unless we redesign that system, it will be impossible to get rid of poverty. Even if you do, it will come back because of the system that you have. I try to explain it by saying that poor people are like bonsai tree. You know, take the seed of the tallest tree in the forest and put in a flower pot. It grows only this high, 2 feet, 3 feet high. Beautiful replica of the forest tree, but it's not as tall. And you wonder what happened. The simple explanation is the seed is good, but you gave only a flower pot to grow. You didn't give the base. So the poor people are bonsai people. There's nothing wrong with their seed. Simply society, the system never gave them the space to grow as tall as possible. So that's where we went wrong. And what I did, tried to address that one simple way, to bring the financial services to the poor people. To me, financial services is like economic oxygen to people. You deny that oxygen to the billions of people in this planet by the system that you have. Then they become dysfunctional because they cannot economically breathe anymore. They become weak. So once you introduce that economic oxygen, they become active. They become they can take care of themselves. That part is to be redesigned. And this is one part. There are many other issues.
There was a report that came out this January from Oxfam that found that 8 men own the same wealth as basically the lower half of the whole world. Bill Gates, Amancio Ortega, who is a Spanish billionaire, Warren Buffett, Carlos Slim Elu, who is a Mexican billionaire, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Ellison, and Michael Bloomberg. The 8 of them have the same amount of wealth as the entire lower half of the world's population. I think a cynical American could look at their wealth and say, there is no way they're going to share. What's the incentive for someone at the top to help anyone that far down at the bottom?
Two questions. One, would they help? This is one. Another one, why should wealth all concentrate in few hands? This is the system that we built. It's a sucking machine. Capitalist system is a sucking machine which sucks up all the wealth and pushes it to the top. Today, we are talking about 8 people owning more wealth than the bottom 4 billion people on this planet. Tomorrow, it will be one person who will be owning more than that. Day after, it will be one person who will be owning 90% of the wealth of the world. This is the direction it's going. It's not reversing. So that's where it is. You say nobody should be left alone, left behind. I'm saying you built a system which specializes in leaving people behind. Mm-hmm. So because you're concentrating all the wealth in fewer and fewer hands, and it is an explosive time bomb. Anytime it can just blow up.
So how do you give me, what would you say is step one if we want to begin reversing that system and move toward a more equitable way of life? What might step one be?
Step one is go back to the system, that the capitalist system, which assumes that all human beings are driven by self-interest. That is the basics of it. Selfishness. I said, if all human beings are selfishness, this is the result you get. But the real human being, not the theoretical human being, the real human being is a combination of both selfishness and selflessness. That selflessness is completely kept out from the capitalist system in the business world. So I said, why don't you introduce that? Selflessness. And what we have done in Bangladesh, and now is spreading, we created another type of business. One that exists is a business to make money. We created a business to solve problem without any intention of making a penny out of that business. An investor can get by the investment money, but he or she doesn't take any profit out of it. Profit is plowed back into the system. We call it social business. So in that social business, you are all focused on solving problem after problem. When the human creativity gets around to address the problem in a sustainable business way, then all these problems can be addressed. At the same time, these social business, the more it become bigger and bigger space in the part of the economy, then they do not contribute in the wealth concentration because nobody is taking any profit out of it. Right. So they reduce that wealth concentration. If you can make it bigger, then you address the problem of poverty, unemployment, housing, you name it.
So you create a space within capitalism, not to say, oh, you shouldn't be making for-profit businesses, but you say, do that if you want, but there should also be room for businesses that exist for people rather than just for profit.
Yeah, this is
you can have both.
This is what we sell. Every business, big business, middle business, small business, we tell them, as you run your business, create a social business on the side so that you bring your creative power to address the problem that you have around you. Take 10 unemployed people out of unemployment by creating a social business. Take five welfare people out of welfare by creating a social business. You run your business. So the more you'll do it, the more you'll be attracted to it. I keep saying that making money is a happiness, but making other people happy is a super happiness. So have a taste of it and see how it feels.
We're speaking to Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize laureate and the author of the new book, A World of Three Zeros, alongside Kristalina Georgieva, the CEO of the World Bank. I wonder, Ms. Georgieva, kind of to what Muhammad Yunus was saying in terms of this shift, this mental shift in the way that we view business. Mark asked on Facebook, what are the World Bank and other organizations doing to transition the world to a post-consumer, ecologically sustainable society? We cannot base human existence on constant consumerism with our limited resources.
What we do is to change the signals that are being sent. What is a good investment and what is a bad investment. And for example, the World Bank was the first institution to issue green bonds, the first institution to issue a sustainable development goals-related indexed bond. The signal is that, as we just heard, doing good and financially being sustainable, they can be combined. We have been working with many countries around the world on that concept of environment, social, and economic sustainability and how they can be integrated in the way societies function. And if I can make a point, what we see more and more among the younger generation is they embrace this product. Impact investing. We are now putting out for the first time IDA bonds. We go to market to raise money to invest in the poor countries. And the queue in front of the World Bank is a kilometer long or a mile long. Everybody wants a piece of these bonds because people want to do good and at the same time retain some financial sustainability.
Yeah, Dr. Yunus, you talk about that. I read the book, and you talk about that in the book, how there is so much disdain among younger people for the way that things are now and so much optimism among the youth, including activity, where are you seeing young people being the most active in terms of making the kinds of changes that you're talking about? Is there one particular example that you could kind of briefly describe that stands out?
Yeah, there are many, many examples. First of all, young people kind of feel depressed with all the negativity that goes around in the world, and they don't see a role for them. What do they do? Because they are in a generation where their parents already done everything that needed to be done, the house, cars, all the things that they are right. looking for. Today, what is it that we add to it? And this is a generation, I would say, most powerful generation in human history because of the technology in their hand. Their parents' generation never had that technology, and no other generation had that. They have the technology, they have the power, they don't know what to use the power for. That's the frustration about. When we come up with the social business idea, they say, this is a good option, that I'm not interested in making money for myself, I'm interested in solving problem. I can do that. And the key to the social business is creativity, and all people, all human beings, not just the young people. All human beings are packed with unlimited creative capacity. But the system doesn't allow that. System asks you to work for somebody. I said, that's the wrong thing. We are not born to work for anybody. So the employment kind of gear, the direction.
Go get a job somewhere.
Get a job. Yeah. As if getting a job is the end of life. I said, human destiny is not getting a job. Job is a tiny, tiny part of human destiny. Human destiny is much bigger than that. I said all human beings are born as entrepreneurs. That's what in our DNA. So we go back to it. We not only educate, we redesign the education system. Education system which only tells you get a good degree and get a good job. And that's the end of the story. That's not the end of the story. We go up, be entrepreneur, be in the world, be a social business entrepreneur, be a profit-making entrepreneur. That's your choice. But be an entrepreneur.
I know we have to let you go, Crystalline, in a moment. But for in terms of that entrepreneurial spirit, for people who look at these problems and say, well, it's a good thing the World Bank is working on this because I'm just me. I'm just little me. I don't have $75 billion in my pocket right now. What does the World Bank want the everyday person to do to help contribute to these goals, briefly?
To recognize that in this world of ours where we are all connected and we all know what is happening somewhere else, what we see is aspirations converging. And we want to make sure that opportunities also converge. So you think in your life, what can you do so there is a chance for the world to be a fairer place? And to young people particularly, speak up. What we see in the world today is that hate is very loud. But hate is not predominant. What is predominant is actually goodness. Problem with goodness? Goodness is very quiet. So you and each and every one of us amplify this voice of goodness. A fairer world is a better world for each and every one of us to wake up in the morning and live in.
Crystalina Georgieva is the CEO of the World Bank. Ms. Georgieva, we really appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you very much for having me. Great conversation.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's continue our conversation now with Muhammad Yunus. We've gotten a variety of comments from you about capitalism itself. John wrote on Twitter, "Capitalism cannot address wealth inequity until economic theory directly incorporates concepts of environmental and social capital and costs." Rob W. wrote on Twitter, "World poverty is less than 10% because of globalized capitalism and less strict socialism, which is better. Middle class is easy. Graduate from high school, work a 40-hour week job, and try not to have a baby before age 21. But Jared wrote on our Facebook page, "In a capitalist system, there are the haves and the have-nots. How can we solve poverty through capitalist mechanisms if the haves are making their profits through the exploitation of the have-nots?" Dr. Yunus, it seems like there's a wide variety of opinions on capitalism as a concept itself, but in the book, you're not arguing that we abandon capitalism for something like, say, socialism. There's a lot of talk, for example, with Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who has described himself as a socialist, and some young people finding that appealing, but you're not arguing for that. You think capitalism can be saved.
I'm saying that present capitalist system is in the wrong direction because of the flaws in its basic assumptions. One basic assumption that all human beings are driven by self-interest. I think it's a grossly mistaken assumption. It should be redesigned to say they are driven by selfishness and also selflessness. Then we have a broader world where we can express our selflessness. How big the selflessness will be, how small or big the selfishness will be, we will decide as we grow up in our families, how they interact, how the education system develops. So it's a kind of mixture between the two. The proportion, you decide what proportion it would be. Once we have that, the whole capitalist system changes drastically. And the second thing, we are not job-driven people. We are not working for somebody else. We are entrepreneurs. We have to create a whole financial system what works for the service of the entrepreneurs, even the person who doesn't have a penny in his or her hand.
I wonder if you get the sense that that word capitalism has just gotten such a heavy connotation. I mean, I tend to think that if NPR was a for-profit company, we'd be the number one network on radio because our values are there and we do something for people that is unique. Being a not-for-profit is very helpful, but I tend to think the values kind of carry across. And I honestly didn't know that you had these views on capitalism until I read your book and found out more. I guess I always assumed that Grameen Bank was kind of anti-capitalist because it wasn't in that same banking vein that's about maximizing shareholder return. I wonder if do we need another way to talk about this? It's just so that people's visceral emotions about the system don't cloud their judgment?
No, it's a very simple thing. It's not an issue that we have to fight about. All we are saying, if you feel that this is a correct description of a human being, that one is both selfish and selfless. And today, the capitalist system that is built is built on only selfishness. Because you say it's a profit-driven system. Maximization of profit is what the goal of every single business. That's why we create the stock market where we go every day, how to make more money. That's the goal of every business. There's a goal of every single individual. But there is no part where how we express the selfless part into that world. So only way you can express your selfless part is in charity. I said charity is a wonderful word and work, but it's not part of the business world. Charity is after you make money, you give it away. And I say giving away is a great thing, but it has a limitation. When you give it away as a charity, money goes out, does a wonderful work, but the money doesn't come back. That's a limitation. You have only one time use of your money. I said, all I'm saying, I take the objective of charity, put a business engine behind it, and make it come back.
We have to pause in a moment, but we'll continue our conversation with Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize laureate and the author of the new book, A World of Three Zeros. We'll get to more of your questions and comments as well, and your thoughts about the future of the way that social enterprise can help eradicate some of the world's most difficult challenges. Stay close. We'll get back to our conversation with Muhammad Yunus, but first, here's how you can get an early start on tomorrow's program. DNA is teaching us more about human beings all the time, including more about our history. It's no longer the exclusive realm of university researchers. Now you can buy a kit online to learn about yourself. Have you used DNA to examine who and what you are? What did you want to learn? How did you go about exploring it? And how did the findings change you? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Tell us your story about using DNA to learn about yourself, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212, and we will share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Muhammad Yunus, the founder of the Grameen Bank, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, and the author of the new book, A World of Three Zeros. We should talk about those other two zeros before our time is up. The first one we've talked about, zero poverty. The other two are zero unemployment and zero net carbon emissions. With unemployment, you push back on the idea in the book of what we in the U.S. refer to as full employment, which is basically we're cool with like 4% unemployment or less, that basically everyone who we presume is able to work does work. But you say that that target is still too high. We shouldn't presume that there's a population that is okay to not be part of the workforce. ideally, what would those people be doing? How would we reintegrate them?
I'm not entering the subject at all in my book. I'm saying that people are not born to work for anybody. So it's not a question of what percentage is unemployed. Because the whole question of all problem of unemployment is created by the concept of employment. Mm-hmm. If you're not looking for employment, there is no unemployment. Why should we look for employment? Because that's, again, a mistake built into the capitalist system. Everybody has to work for somebody else. I said, what happened to our history? In our history, we were never sending job applications. When we're in the caves, we're not sending job applications from cave number 5 to cave number 10, give me a job. We didn't do that. If we did that, we'll be dead. We went ahead and did things, and we became hunters, we became gatherers, we became farmers. That's our history. Only in recent years, recent centuries, that when capitalist idea came, somebody has to own the wealth, and we have to work for it. We have to become the mercenaries for all the wealth catchers. So all the wealth catchers become the 8 people in the world. We are the mercenaries for them to help them do that. I said, why are you doing that and blaming them? They are not at fault. System is at fault. Why don't you become entrepreneur? If we are all become entrepreneur, then we will be all wealth catchers ourselves. So wealth will be distributed from all of us.
Now, I think that idea of entrepreneur, at least here in the U.S., has a very specific meaning in terms, especially with someone who's in tech or someone who like starts a business, something either brick and mortar or that has venture capital funding. You have done work here in the U.S. with a Grameen Bank model, particularly with low-income women. Can you give us a sense of how you work with low-income women in the U.S. to maybe be kind of more entrepreneurial, to create their own enterprise? How does that work?
First of all, look at the microcredit in Bangladesh or USA, everywhere that you see. What do they do? Women take in Bangladesh $30 loan, $40 loan, start a business. That's what they do. They pay back. They take another loan. Step by step, they move up. What do the women in USA do? We have Grameen America. They have 20 branches within the United States right now. Started in January 2008. They have loaned out to 100,000 borrowers, all women. And the total loan they have taken together is about $1 billion already. And they pay back every penny of them with interest. And they start business. Each one has a business idea, comes up with it. One doesn't have a business idea. Everybody say, hey, this, you can do that. What are you doing? This could be a good business too. She was not aware of it. The fact that she makes artifacts, she makes some simple clothing and so on, designs. She didn't realize she does it for her family. So somebody said, you can sell that. Okay, I can take a loan, I can make the materials and sell it. So they become entrepreneurs, every one of them entrepreneurs. We have 9 million borrowers in Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. They are all entrepreneurs. Illiterate women in the village who never crossed the boundary of the village. She becomes entrepreneur by $20, $30 loan. Why educated young people or any age should sit idle? Only thing missing is the finance. No bank in the city here or any city anywhere, any bank, will give a loan to an unemployed young person who has a brilliant business idea to start the business. That's what the cause of the whole unemployment situation, because he has no option, she has no option. Well, to work for somebody else.
And it kind of sends a message. I mean, it's funny you mentioned that, because as soon as you said that, I thought, like, I grew up in the 80s, and I thought about the birth of hip-hop. Right? That is exactly how hip-hop music got started. It was people who had a skill, they had $0, but they used what they had, and they proved that you may not find me valuable, you may not find me creditworthy, but I know I have value, and I'm just going to make it happen one way or another. It's kind of... It sounds kind of like this. I mean, I don't know if I'm hearing you wrong, but it sounds the same as that.
This is exactly the same. They had to work against the system. What I'm saying, why do we have to work against it? Why doesn't the system work with me? System is created to fit me. I'm not created to fit the system. That's what the whole problem is. So I want to be an entrepreneur. I said, at least in our families, those who are listeners and everybody, in your families, you talk to your children that you have two options, son and daughter, you have two options. You can be a job seeker, you can work for somebody, some company, some office, or you can be an entrepreneur yourself. Make up your mind. So today, we don't say that. The only thing we say, get a good school, get a good grade, and get a good job. And then life is finished. And if you don't get it, oh, sorry, you didn't get it, you're unemployed. I said, how can a young person fully prepared, at the peak of energy, sit idle, do nothing? I said, it doesn't fit to a description of a human being. Human being is a go-getter. Simply, we paralyze them by our theory. We put a spell on those people. You can't do it. You have to depend on the welfare. So wait for the government to feed you. Mm-hmm. I said, feeding people is not a solution. Feeding people is a kind of a diminishing human being. Human being is a creative person. Human being is somebody who contributes to the world, not just take care of themselves.
Now, I should note that, you know, even in the standards of the Grameen Bank, there's a list of promises, of principles.
We call it principles.
That's, yeah,
16 principles.
The 16 principles. And among those, one of them deals with helping the person kind of to the left and to the right, that you're not just
yourself.
Building this enterprise for yourself, but you are intentionally, as a condition of getting the funding, promising to help build a larger community. Is that right?
That's right. Excellent.
Yasoda emailed, isn't the main problem with moving wealth more equitably around the world or a country the factor of interest? Microloans come with the burden of repaying the loan plus interest. How difficult would it be to move to a no-interest economic model or even a negative interest model? We need to rethink capitalism consumerism as the only model.
Yeah, go ahead. Create those models instead of just talking about it. Go ahead and design it. Place it. And if you have no interest, even negative interest, somebody has to pay. So that's a charity model. You don't have to give a loan. You just give the money away. That's a charity model. A charity model has a limitation. I'm not saying this is the wrong one. It's a dependent model. You have to depend on raising money every year to run it the same thing all over again. So that's kind of the limitation. You cannot expand yourself because nobody is giving the money. In Grameen Bank, we lend out right now over $2.5 billion every year. That money is generated within the system. We take care of all the costs, and it's a sustainable business model. So the same thing happens in USA. The Grameen America is a sustainable model. Each branch covers its own cost. It has no limit how big it can be. Simply, we don't have the banking license in the United States, so we have to find money outside to borrow money and then lend money to the people. Otherwise, no, I don't have to go out and borrow money, because if I had the simple business license to bank to take deposits, then we can grow all over the country.
So you could basically, like, I could close my account now, and instead of going to Wells Fargo or Bank of America, I could just say, hey, Grameen, open a checking account.
And so then I use the money to lend money to the people. You got your money, I got money to lend money to people. That's it. And our plan is in the next 10 years to raise it to 500,000 borrowers, very modest plan, and go up to $10 billion in loan, because money is rolling back again, because with the 99.5% repayment rate, you're not losing any money. That money keeps on circulating, expand that capacity of that money.
The third zero in your book is zero net carbon emissions. There are a number of efforts underway, of course. The Paris Climate Agreement is still in the works, even though the United States is formally pulling out of it. What do you think is the Paris Climate Agreement enough? Is that a step in the right direction? What more might need to be done to hit that goal? Or are we kind of on track already?
This was the most important decision the world has ever taken on the climate issue. Paris Agreement. It took years and years, something about 45 years, to generate that emotions and generate that awareness to protect this planet. And civil society people pressed the government. It was not the initiative government. It was the citizens who mobilized the force to rally around this global warming issue and pressed their government to come and make a decision. So they came finally. In the meantime, many other rounds of meetings held, but never a decision taken. Paris is important because finally all the countries of the world made a decision, we are going to take action to protect this planet before we cross the point of no return. And that was a very important decision. Then other policies have to come, and now policies come. Unfortunately, USA suddenly withdrew from that. That's a very unfortunate thing, negative thing that happens to the world. I hope USA will come back and take the leadership of the whole movement. What social business can do, we can create social business to address the problem of fossil fuel or just the problem of food and waste and everything that we have. We create a lot of them. We created solar energy program in Bangladesh to bring solar home system in every family in Bangladesh, but as a social business, not to make money for ourselves to make sure people who are using kerosene lamp, they have never seen electricity in their life. They have solar energy, and suddenly they have electricity connectivity for the whole world. So this, now we have nearly about 4 million homes with solar energy in Bangladesh because of the initiative that we have taken in Bangladesh. And we became the largest off-grid system in the whole world. So all this idea, once you move away from the profit-centric idea, and suddenly all the creative ideas come into you, make things happen. All the technology will be generated. We can create artificial intelligence to solve the problem of healthcare. Healthcare should be as close as costless so that anybody, anywhere can get the health. We can create artificial intelligence as a doctor who solves all your problems on the internet.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Before we go, I know our time is short. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you for your perspectives, considering that you are so steeped, grew up in Bangladesh and work so deeply there, about the crisis of Rohingya Muslims who are kind of streaming over the border from Myanmar into Bangladesh. More than 500,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled to Bangladesh since late August, when an attack on Myanmar security posts catalyzed this brutal counteroffensive. The human rights chief at the U.S., Zayed Rud al-Hussein, spoke about the Rohingya crisis last month.
Because Myanmar has refused access to human rights investigators, the current situation cannot yet be fully assessed. But the situation remains, or seems, a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. My investigation suggests the possibility that crimes against humanity may have been committed, which can only be confirmed by a subsequent criminal investigation.
That was UN Human Rights Chief Zayed Rud al-Hussein speaking last month about the Rohingya crisis. Dr. Yunus, there's an open letter to the UN Security Council signed by at least a dozen Nobel laureates, including yourself, who called for the UN to end the Rohingya crisis. You've been rather critical openly of Aung San Suu Kyi, a fellow Nobel Peace Prize laureate who's kind of the de facto political head of Myanmar. What do you think needs to be done to end this crisis?
Mobilize the whole world opinion so that every government become conscious. Many governments already said it's a genocide. Now you declare it's a genocide. If you don't do anything, that will be against your conscience, that you call it a genocide and don't take any action. You have to stop this. Today, more than 500,000 of those Rohingyas have moved in a panicky way, not just walk in a panicky way, to save their life into Bangladesh. And another, by the end of the year, UN is predicting that it will be crossing million of people coming. The total number of Rohingyas in Burma or Myanmar is supposedly 1 million or 1.1 million people. So literally the ethnic cleansing is complete when you put this away. What is their fault? They were living there for generations. This is their country. That's where they grew up. And that's how they had citizenship. They had participated in politics. They're parliament members. They're ministers in that country. Suddenly in 1982, military government says, no, Rohingyas are not citizens of this country anymore. That's the crisis. That's the point. And the shameful thing is Nobel Peace Laureate turned completely around, who is admired by the whole world, showered all the admiration on her because her stand on human rights, her stand on democracy, suddenly she became a representative of terror. She is forcing people to leave, killing people in her country. So world has to mobilize itself. In a situation like that, we cannot just sit idle and see these things happening.
We should note that the latest report from the UN says 582,000 Rohingya have now crossed into Bangladesh. I know our time is very, very short, but I wonder, as we're wrapping up our conversation, I think when we look at crises like the crisis of Rohingya Muslims fleeing Myanmar into Bangladesh, when we look at the three zeros in this book that we're aiming for, the problems seem gigantic. Social business, as you've described it, is making a difference, can potentially make a larger one for people who don't necessarily feel motivated to start a business or to start an enterprise. For people who might say, I'm fine being an employee if I'm an employee of someone who's doing good things. What else are you looking for the everyday person to do? Is it a big step like starting an enterprise, or are there smaller things that you think that people around the world should be doing right now?
One thing that they can talk to their children, if they're adults and they have their family and children, that they have two options in their life. They can become either an employee like himself or herself, or can become an entrepreneur. If they are entrepreneur, these are the path they have to take. And if they are entrepreneur, they have also two options as an entrepreneur. They can be money-making entrepreneurs, profit-making entrepreneurs, fine with them, no problem. problem, but they can also be a social business entrepreneur so that they can solve the problem of the world creating social business. They can do both. They can create money-making business. They can give social business. So this is one option that I suggest. Another one I would say, I may not be able to create a social business, but I can think about a social business, design a social business. Simple thing is how to take 5 unemployed young people out of unemployment. Can I design a business which will run well and these 5 young people would be involved in it? They have decent salary, and only intention of my creating this business is to solve the problem of 5 unemployed people. In theory, not in practice. And then I feel good that I have done that and I never take any profit, but my investment will come back to me, but I will never take it. It will be plowed back into the business so that in future it can employ the 6th person and so on. Anybody can do that.
Mohamed Yunus, the recipient of the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize and the author of A World of 3 Zeros, The New Economics of Zero Poverty, Zero Unemployment, and Zero Carbon Emissions. Dr. Yunus, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.